This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, allegations of covert action inside Iran. Journalist Seymour Hersh is reporting in the latest issue of The New Yorker magazine that covert operations funded by the United States are underway inside Iran to destabilize the religious leadership. The article quotes sources who say that President Bush signed a presidential finding late last year authorizing $400 million for covert actions designed to undermine Iran's nuclear ambitions and undermine the strength of the country's leadership. To execute that finding, the Bush administration had to brief a small circle of congressional leaders, among them House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Intelligence Chair Senator John Rockefeller. Hersh writes, although some legislators were troubled by aspects of the finding, and there was a significant amount of high-level discussion about it, according to a source familiar with it, the funding for the escalation was approved. In other words, some members of the Democratic leadership were willing, in secret, to go along with the administration in expanding covert activities directed at Iran, while the party's presumptive candidate for president, Barack Obama, has said that he favors direct talks and diplomacy. The story also asserts that the covert actions authorized in the finding will operate along with a military task force underway inside Iran and being run by the Joint Special Operations Command. The Bush administration has denied that U.S. forces are specifically operating across the Iraqi border into Iran, but they have not denied the essence of Hersh's story. Today, we've asked two foreign policy experts to address some of the questions raised in Seymour Hersh's story and to talk to us this morning about some of the latest news out of Iran. What would these covert operations involve? Why were there not more objections from Democratic members of Congress? And what will the reaction be inside Iran? Our guest this hour, Suzanne Maloney, is a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, and she's with us this morning from Washington. Suzanne Maloney, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
We're also joined today by Abbas Milani of Stanford University, where he is head of Iranian studies, and he's with us this morning from Palo Alto. And Professor Milani, thank you for joining us for the hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I should also tell our listeners that we requested an interview with Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker, but he is traveling out of the country today, and we'll play some of the excerpts from his lengthy interview Monday night with Fresh Air's Terry Gross. Suzanne, first to some news out of Tehran and out of the U.S. this morning. The oil minister in Tehran is saying that any attacks on Iran will provoke what he's calling a fierce response, and this comes after a commander in the U.S. Navy fleet said that in a meeting in Saudi Arabia that the U.S. will not allow Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz to international oil shipping. Will you tell me if you think this is just more posturing or if there's something else going on here?
Well, I think what we're seeing is, in recent weeks, just an escalation of some of the rhetoric on all sides. Rhetoric coming out of Tehran, some of the rhetoric here in Washington, and also, relevantly, some of the rhetoric coming out of Israeli leaders. I don't see it necessarily as linked to any plans or likely prospects for imminent military action, but obviously, you know, the prospects of some sort of clash have been long a worry, both from a security perspective, but also with respect to the oil markets. And there certainly is a premium, I think, already built into the price of oil with respect to the prospects for some sort of a conflict between the U.S. and Iran. You know, it's also worthwhile to highlight that there's some other interesting news coming out of Iran over the past few days on the oil front, on the nuclear front, which suggests that there may be some traction on the Iranian side, some interest in actually taking advantage of the latest offer from the permanent five members of the UN Security Council plus the United plus Germany for negotiations on the nuclear issue. So we're seeing an escalation of some bombastic rhetoric, but we're also seeing possibly new hope for negotiations between Iran and the world community.
Do you think any new negotiations on the nuclear issue here will have to wait for the next administration?
That's certainly been the conventional wisdom, and I know that has been my presumption for some time, that the Iranians were hedging and looking to see what they might be able to do with a new U.S. administration. But obviously, the pressure of some of the financial measures that the U.S. has enacted unilaterally, that the U.N. and the EU have put in place on Iranian banks are having some actual impact on the ground in Iran. And I think there's a recognition that, you know, the next 6 months are a critical period, that there are some factions on all sides here that have been looking possibly to take military action in advance of a change of administrations on the U.S. side. And so I think what the Iranians are going to try to do is probably play for time, look for some way to begin some sort of a dialogue. I don't think we'll make any substantial breakthrough before a new U.S. administration, but obviously if we do, that would be a terrific outcome.
Professor Milani, back to this question of what the oil minister in Tehran was saying. Would it be possible for the Iranians to actually close the Strait of Hormuz or make it much more difficult for international oil shipping through that area?
If you look at the map and look at how small the Strait of Hormuz is and look where Iran sits vis-a-vis the Strait, I think it would be very conceivable for them to make it very difficult for ships to travel through. Can they permanently or semi-permanently close it? I don't know. It depends how much the U.S. is willing to fight back, how much the U.S. is willing to use its Navy and its Air Force to bomb Iranian bases there. But obviously they can make it very, very uncomfortable for oil travel from the Strait of Hormuz and from the rest of the Persian Gulf. I mean, they sit on the greatest piece of real estate on the Persian Gulf, and they have missiles that can hit ships. They have missiles that can hit U.S. bases around the Persian Gulf. So if push comes to shove and they decide to go all out, and I'm not sure the Iranian leadership, and at least in my view, most of the leadership, there are some in Iran who also are itching for a fight with the U.S., as there are some in Washington who are itching for this fight. But the majority don't want this fight, and they want to avoid it at all costs. But if push comes to shove, I think they have plenty of ammunition to use to make life difficult for the rest of oil producers in the region.
Do you agree with Suzanne Maloney that there is something interesting happening here, even as we're hearing this escalation of rhetoric in Washington and in Tehran? There seems to be some interest, as she pointed out, in starting some serious negotiations again about their nuclear ambitions.
Well, I don't think that's anything new. The regime in Iran has played it very cleverly in the past. If you look at their behavior in the past, they have always done this. They have kept their options open. They have dangled different alternatives in face of the international community. Remember that they are trying to break the united front that has been formed against them. The 5+1 is for them a bad situation. They need to get China and Russia out of this unity. And for them to be able to get China and Russia to make a forceful argument against a stricter embargo or against the military invasion, they need to show that they are being accommodating. So. As always in the past, they have sent confusing, differing, sometimes contradictory signals, and they will keep their options open. And, if push comes again to shove and they think that the chips are down and that they might be going towards a military confrontation, they might be willing to negotiate. This is a regime that has shown a willingness to negotiate when it faces a serious, credible force.
And Suzanne Maloney, one more question about that before we turn to some of the details in Seymour Hersh's story here. As Professor Milani says, do you think Iran has a good chance of trying to, not isolate, I guess, but trying to work with Russia and China and use that alliance to, you know, to throw up some obstacles with what some of the other countries, Germany, U.S., France, might want to do?
Well, I think, as Professor Milani pointed out, Russia and China are really key to the diplomatic strategies of both sides. From the perspective of here in Washington, it's a struggle to try to get them on board for more punitive measures. They have been less ready to risk their overall relationship with Iran in terms of implementing really serious sanctions. They've always been sort of the drags on the UN Security Council process. And to the extent that they're the weak link, they encourage even some within Europe to lose their will in terms of confronting Iran. From the Iranian perspective, I think there is a recognition that they can't necessarily fully trust the Russians. There's a long history there. But the Russians and Chinese do have a different perception of the strategic threat from Iran, a different perception of the value of the long-term relationship. And so they're always looking for ways to try to leverage the differences between Russia and China and the rest of the P5 plus one. So, you know, both sides are working this, and I agree fully with what Dr. Milani has said, that, you know, the negotiating tactics, the sort of sudden flurry of interest that you see from Tehran, really in contrast from the previous time that the P5 plus one presented an offer where the Iranians really did cold shoulder it with very little finesse at all. But this time, I think that, as he said, what they're trying to do is at least slow down any progress toward more punitive steps or toward any support for military action and play the clock out on the Bush administration.
And Professor Milani, will they essentially be able to do that in hopes that whoever the next administration is led by, that there will be a change in terms for some kind of negotiation?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have to remember that even the Europeans, although they talk tough, they continue to trade with this regime. Germany's trade with Iran over the last 6 months has increased comparable to the similar period last year. So while Germany signs this and talks like China and Russia, they're doing business, as is England, as is France, as is Italy. So the Europeans have a very interesting game they play. They talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And the regime, with oil at $140 and increasing, has a lot of money to throw around and a lot of money to get a lot of countries interested to accommodate for it. Will they succeed in doing this indefinitely? I'm not sure. I think they realize that the Bush administration is in a moment of existential desperation. They have like Dylan says, nothing to lose, and if you got nothing to lose, you're a very dangerous force. And
we'll talk a bit more about that in our conversation as we turn to the specifics that appeared in Seymour Hersh's article. If you're listening in this morning, we're talking with our guests about some of the latest news out of Iran. You may have heard the news this morning, a U.S. naval commander saying that the United States will not allow Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz. The oil minister in Tehran saying that if they are provoked, they will respond with a fierce response, talking about the potential of a military attack. All of this comes on top of some of the details in this story of Seymour Hersh's that appears in the July 7th edition of the New Yorker magazine. We're going to talk about the details of that in just a moment with our guest. Dr. Abbas Milani is with us of Stanford University, where he's head of Iranian studies, joining us from Palo Alto, California. And Suzanne Maloney is with us. She's a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, joining us this morning from Washington. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have questions about some of the rhetoric that you're hearing, some of the geopolitical maneuvering going on between the United States, some of the other Western nations, and Iran, 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, online today at minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question to Tom in St. Paul. Hi, Tom. You're on Mid Morning.
Good morning. I was wondering, it seems to me like a big chess game. On one hand, you have Israel and Cheney wanting, you know, chomping at the bit to go in and take out those nuclear sites. And on the other hand, you have the fact that if they do that, world economy is going to have a huge issue with the price of oil. My one question was, what is the opportunity for Iran to hit Saudi Arabia's oil fields, or more importantly, their production area where they process the oil? And, you know, the aspect of Seymour Hersh, where he's talking about us undermining, going in and undermining the Iranian, I feel like that's sort of a give me to the Israelis to say, hold off, we're doing what we can to undermine them. It's like I said, it seems like a big chess game.
Mm. Suzanne Maloney, I think to that first question about Saudi Arabia.
Yes, I mean, this has been a long-time concern for a variety of reasons, not simply what the Iranian reach is, but the Iranian ability to interact with any disaffected forces. The oil-producing province of Saudi Arabia has a strong Shia majority, and so the Iranians had historically developed relationships with militant groups there. There has been a lot done to try to deal with the infrastructure security questions with all of our Gulf allies. This has been an ongoing dialogue, part of something that the Bush administration launched called the Gulf Security Dialogue. But obviously, it remains a concern. The Iranians have both potentially subversive capabilities as well as intermediate-range missiles that could hit oil production facilities in any of the Gulf states. And so this is why you find a lot of trepidation on the part of the Gulf states, not simply for Iranian policy, but for any escalation on any side, because they recognize that they are potentially first in the line of fire for any kind of Iranian retaliation.
And Tom, we'll flesh out the details here of what Seymour Hersh is reporting in just a moment. I just wanted to take a couple calls on the latest news. So let me take a call here from David in Minneapolis. Hi, David. You're on the Morning Question for us.
Yeah, I had a quick question about, you know, when we were about to go to war with Iraq, was it, you know, 7-8 years ago, we had heard that they had this superior military force and there was going to be a ton of casualties. I'm just wondering, is it the same thing in Iran? Is it the same sort of rhetoric that, you know, they're just sort of bolstering themselves up to sound tougher than they really are? And will we find that they really have no capabilities? I'm just sort of wondering if it's the same thing as Iraq.
Yeah, good question. Dr. Maloney, what is the capability of the services there within Iran?
I think it would be a great mistake to compare Iran today with Iraq on the eve of the second war. Remember that there had been a war in 1991. There had been a continuous war of attrition against Iraq from 1991 all the way till the second war the U.S. had. Saddam Hussein's army was decimated in the first 1990 war. He was deprived of much of the oil wealth that was coming to him. So Saddam in 2000 was a shadow of Saddam in 1990 when he invaded Kuwait. Iran today has triple the size of Iraq. Hmm. It has a different geography. It is not a flat land where you can send your tanks and go in. It has a much, much stronger army that hasn't been decimated. It has an infrastructure that hasn't been decimated. And because of the oil windfall, it has been able to cultivate very close alliances with Hezbollah in Lebanon, with the Hamas in Gaza, with the Zayd movement in Yemen, with the Bahraini Shiites, with Shiites in Saudi Arabia, with Shiites in Iraq. So, and it has missiles that can hit even Israel. And I think one of the concerns that Israel has is that Iran has the capability of using missiles that go as far as Israel goes. So I don't think that they would be comparable. I think it is not empty bluster. Obviously, there's some element of bluff. There's some element of bravura in what they say. Obviously, they're not as strong as they think they are, but I think it would be a grave mistake to think that they're as much of a depleted force as Saddam was when the U.S. invaded the second time.
A question for both of you online here from Ali in Minneapolis. Would you comment on the resurgence of Mr. Larijani and what effect that might have on the direction of nuclear negotiations? Suzanne Maloney, will you tackle that one first?
I can start. Mr. Larijani is, of course, the former nuclear negotiator who resigned a little over a year ago, largely because of his differences with Mr. Ahmadinejad, the president, on how one should go about negotiations with the world community on the nuclear program. Larijani is now taken the helm of the parliament as speaker of the most recently elected parliament, which gives him some capacity to both shape policy, to give himself a more prominent role in decision making, and potentially launch a competitive presidential bid against Mr. Ahmadinejad in next year's elections. I tend to think some of the hype about Larijani, there's a lot of interest in him as a potential pragmatic who we could deal with. I believe that may be a little bit overstated. I don't know that the Europeans found negotiating with Mr. Larijani all that productive. He has a very long track record as a fairly hardline conservative, very close to the Supreme Leader. And he also has demonstrated very little ability to gain a great deal of popularity at the ballot box. So I think it's an interesting factor to watch as all these shifts within the Iranian political elite are. But I wouldn't position much hope on Mr. Larijani as an alternative power center who would move Iran in a substantially different direction than Mr. Ahmadinejad has.
So, Dr. Milani, you agree with that really the reemergence of Mr. Larijani is not the reason why they seem to be interested again in negotiations, again, this idea that with one hand they do this, with the other they do that, and it's crafty negotiations?
I think it is crafty negotiations, and I think the ultimate decision makers on the nuclear issue is neither Mr. Larijani nor Mr. Ahmadinejad, who keeps talking tough, but in reality has very little to do with the formulation of policy. Policy at the nuclear level is formed by Mr. Khamenei, who is the spiritual leader, and a very small coterie of clerics who have been essentially the brain trust of this regime since Khomeini died. That includes, for example, Rafsanjani. It includes Mahdavi Kani. It includes four or five clerics other than Khamenei, who are each a power center to themselves, and they formulate policy. Larijani or Mr. Azizi or Mr. Ahmadinejad are instruments of this power trust. And that power trust has been very clever in using all tactics at its disposal to delay, to confuse the West, to send confusing tactics, to use the greed of Western companies. The Iranian foreign minister yesterday, said that there are American companies working in Iran, multiple American companies defying the embargo and working in Iran. The vice president's ex-company was working in Iran till about a year ago.
Halliburton
mm-hmm. was working in Iran till about a year ago. When they have the cohesion of leadership that comes with a despotic society, and when they have oil at $140, and when they have, as their opponent, a clumsy administration, like the current Bush administration, that keeps setting up these home runs for the Islamic Republic. The Islamic Republic of Iran is today stronger than it has ever been because of this clumsiness, because of the blunders that this administration has made throughout the Middle East, this regime to become what it has become. The next administration, whoever it is going to have a very hard time putting this genie back in the box. And so Larijani is an instrument, I think, of that centralized clerical leadership. And remember, part of what this tough talk does is kill the possibility of any democratic change in Iran. This regime, before this heightened rhetoric of war, was having extremely serious economic political difficulties. Go back to Iran's domestic politics 10 days ago, and it was a crisis. You had a member of the regime name 44 of the top government officials for financial corruption, billions of dollars of stealing from the public coffers. You had the economy in shambles, and now everything has been subsumed with the fear of war. And this rhetoric does something to the domestic situation in Iran and to the possibility that the Iranian people, the Iranian democratic movement, can take care of its business and bring a government, a democratic government to Iran. And that, in my mind, is the only solution to Iran's nuclear problem. Mm-hmm. Iran's nuclear problem does not have a military solution. Iran's nuclear problem has a political solution, and the political solution is with having a regime in Iran that the world can be at peace with.
Dr. Abbas Milani is one of our guests this morning. He is at Stanford, where he's head of the Iranian Studies Program there. Suzanne Maloney is joining us this morning. She's a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution, where she specializes in Iran. You heard Dr. Milani talking about the religious clerics and that being the area where the center of power resides in Iran. We're going to take a break for news, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of what Seymour Hersh reported about U.S. attempts to undermine the religious leadership in Iran, these clerics that we're hearing about this morning, the implications of that, why members, Democratic members of Congress, went along with this presidential finding, and what the reaction may be inside Iran. Talking about that, we'll hear a couple of clips from Seymour Hersh's lengthy interview on Monday night on Fresh Air. He is out of the country, could not spend the hour with us this morning, but we'll hear some of what he said about the reporting on his story. We'll take a break. When we come back, more of your calls and questions as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And if you're online and listening and want to join us this hour, and I hope you will, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, and click on Send a Question. Back in a moment to the newsroom and Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Carrie, hundreds of people in downtown Jerusalem fled in panic today as a Palestinian heavy equipment driver attacked with his machine. At least three people died, 45 people were injured, the attacker was killed. A slightly stronger U.S. dollar kept crude oil prices in check, but they still rose above $141 a barrel today. Supply concerns and Middle East tensions have analysts warning more spikes are possible. Iran has used the World Petroleum Congress today to warn of a fierce response to any attack. Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy and its Gulf allies are vowing to prevent Iran from sealing off 40% of the world's oil supply in the Strait of Hormuz. The National Guard will help crews battling wildfires across northern and central California. About 200 Guard troops are being called to ground-based firefighting for the first time since 1977. About 19,000 firefighters are on the job. A bar in Granite, Illinois is known as a police hangout, but that's where an ex-convict suspected in eight killings was captured today. Nicholas Sheely was being sought in two states. Bar patrons recognized him and tipped authorities. Republican presidential candidate John McCain says free trade agreements like NAFTA are good for the U.S. He is visiting Colombia and Mexico and promoting more free trade deals. The tickets for Barack Obama's visit to Fargo tomorrow have all been taken. An Obama campaign spokeswoman says about 1,000 tickets were distributed before the supply ran out yesterday. The Minnesota Supreme Court is considering a petition to ease rules that prevent televised trials. Minnesota's judicial rules permit TV cameras in court if the judge, prosecution, and defense all sign off, but that has seldom happened. Weather forecast today, partly to mostly sunny skies, high temperatures mid-60s to low 70s. Right now in the Twin Cities, west winds at 15, gusting to 30 miles per hour, temperatures 73, and the skies are mostly sunny. It's 9:34. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Have a question about the election?
How much power does the president actually have?
What difference would that make to the outcome?
Are they getting paid? How do they vote?
Why can't we just wait until it happens and see who wins?
Minnesota Public Radio's ElectionWise podcast is here to help.
Every week we,
Curtis Gilbert
and Molly Bloom,
take a question from you
about the election, the candidates, or the issues,
and find an answer.
So send us a question
and subscribe to the ElectionWise podcast
at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org.
It's in the programs menu!
Under ElectionWise.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mittauwakaton Sioux community, who have given 254 defibrillators to charitable organizations, schools, and others. To request an AED for your organization, you can go to ShakopeeDakota.org.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, oh, this should be a lively conversation. New research that tells us that even though more and more and more women are moving into the workforce full-time with families, we're finding out that although many of the men in those households believe that they are contributing more to the parenting and more to the household work, they're not. Women still do double the parenting, and 5-1. That's the ratio on the household chores. We'll talk about why that is. Interesting new research about this. I'm definitely going to want to hear from you what your experience is with this in your own household. That's at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at 9. DFL Senate nominee Al Franken in the studio for the hour. We have a lot to cover. I hope you'll join in on that conversation. Al Franken with us tomorrow morning in the studio at 9. And back to our conversation this hour with our guests. We're talking about some of the latest news out of Iran and talking about the news in Seymour Hersh's article that appears in the July 7th edition of The New Yorker magazine. We've asked Suzanne Maloney to be with us, senior fellow at the Saban Center, and Abbas Milani is with us from Stanford University. And Suzanne, let me outline some of the details of Seymour Hersh's article here for some of our listeners who might not have read it yet. He is essentially saying that President Bush went to Congress late last year to get authority from, I guess, the Gang of Eight, this mix of Democrats and Republicans in Congress, for $400 million, for a presidential finding that would authorize $400 million to be used inside Iran to undermine the religious leadership there, to try to help some of the religious minority organizations there, and to do some other work to destabilize the government there. We hear a lot about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's role in this. We've heard Dr. Milani say this morning that really the power does reside among these religious clerics. I guess I'm asking you, how effective, if what Seymour Hersh is reporting is right, how effective can the U.S. be in trying to destabilize this religious leadership there?
I think, first, I'd preface what I have to say by suggesting that I can't confirm or validate anything that's in the article. I think it's important to take it with some of the allegations with a grain of salt, given that they're not fully substantiated. But the essence of the article, the suggestion that the U.S. is interested in trying to stir up ethnic instability in Iran to destabilize the regime, seems at least generally credible to me. And in terms of your specific question, I think it's an absolutely disastrous approach to dealing with this regime.
Why?
In Iran. Iran is a profoundly nationalistic population. There are ethnic populations that do have longstanding grievances with the central government over socioeconomic issues, religious issues, cultural autonomy. But ultimately, I see very little prospect that you could actually incite successful pressure on the regime in a way that would persuade it to moderate its policies, or that by inciting separatist ethnic movements that you're going to actually produce a more coherent and more moderate Iranian regime as a successor. I think what you're likely to do is create an enormous amount of antipathy among a population that has generally been relatively supportive and sympathetic toward the U.S., even throughout this long estrangement. And what you're likely to do is potentially destabilize very important stability projects in both Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as Pakistan, which have co-ethnic populations. The story talks about efforts to promote instability among Ahwazi Arabs in the southwestern part of Iran, as well as Baluch in the southeastern part of Iran. And so you're talking about populations that bleed over to other countries where the U.S. has a very strong interest in doing as much to stabilize those countries. So there really is no positive outcome to this whatsoever. As I understand it, and it does seem credible from what I know of U.S. policy from some time spent at the State Department, there is an interest in trying to demonstrate to the Iranians that we can cause them pain in the same way that they've been able to cause us pain in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think this is a profoundly wrong-headed way to do it that could have a deeply problematic impact on all of our goals in terms of Iran.
Dr. Milani, Vali Nazer is quoted in that article, essentially, that Seymour Hersh wrote, essentially saying that the United States is misreading the history and the politics of Iran, much as I think we now know the U.S. misread the history and politics of Iraq. Do you agree with what Suzanne Maloney is saying today, that this is a disastrous approach?
I think it is for some of the reasons that Susan said and some more. First of all, people who would take money from the U.S. government are usually not the most bona fide Iranian Democrats. in Iran, as in any country, accepting money from a foreign source to destabilize your country is not something that genuine Democrats do. Iranian genuine Democrats, people who are in prison, people who are actually fighting this regime, not people who are sitting in coffee shops in Washington and trying to cheat Uncle Sam out of a few million dollars, have said repeatedly that this kind of a rhetoric from Washington is not only not helping the democratic forces in Iran, who are the ones who are in fact undermining this regime, but it's counterproductive. It is helping the regime. And it is not going to Iranian Democrats because they have been on more than one occasion very clear that they don't want this money. No self-respecting Democrat will accept money from another country to undermine their own government. I mean, would any Democrat in this country, any genuine Democrat with a small d, accept money from China to undermine the Bush administration?
But this is not a repressive regime as there is in Iran. If some of these organizations there believe that they needed outside help in a repressive place like Iran, why wouldn't they be likely to take it?
Because anyone who would accept money from an outside government will lose all democratic credibility inside Iran. This is a very oppressive regime, and the people who I'm talking about, the Iranian Democrats, are the ones who have been at the receiving end of this regime's oppression. They're the ones who have gone to prison. They obviously understand the oppressive nature of this regime, but you have to allow the Iranian Democratic Movement to take care of this regime. The best the U.S. can do is not help the regime. When you increase the price of oil to $140, when you destroy Iraq and allow this regime to become its dominant force, you're undermining the Iranian Democratic Movement. You're making it that much more difficult for them being the Iranian Democrats, to get rid of this regime. There is incredible disgruntlement with this regime inside Iran. This is a deeply isolated regime inside Iran. This is a deeply corrupt regime inside Iran.
So, are you saying, Dr. Mullally, events take their course? I mean, that's what the U.S. should do.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying to take a judicious approach, take a firm, judicious policy approach towards the regime and help the Iranian Democratic Movement. No, the U.S. has major interests in that region. U.S. is a big power. I'm not suggesting that it should sit on its hands. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that it shouldn't inadvertently, at least, help the regime. Let me give you a concrete example. When there was a reformist president who wanted to establish ties with the U.S., when there was a majority in the parliament of Iran who were on record as saying we should move towards normalizing relations with Iran, President Bush gave his Axis of Evil speech. Mm-hmm. And that killed the possibility of negotiation from the reformists or any talk of rapprochement with the U.S. for a couple of years. This recent flurry of activity is going down, in my view, the same path. It is counterproductive. I'm not sure to what extent Simon Hirsch is right. His recent reportings on Iran have not been very accurate. He has tended to exaggerate. Sometimes he seems to be used by those who want to engage in a war of propaganda. As Susan said, I don't know what his reporting is based on. I know that some of his past reporting on Iran has not been very reliable. 2-3 years ago, he said that U.S. has been sending special forces, using the MEK as the special forces into Iran. And as far as I know, very little has materialized on that. But my suggestion is not that the U.S. should not do anything. My suggestion, in fact, is that the U.S. should be very proactive about Iran.
Let me play a little bit of the Seymour Hirsch interview that he did with Terry Gross, in which he talks about some of the reporting that he did for the story. And this is a part of the interview where he talks about what he believes the Bush administration is up to in the waning days of the second term here. Let's listen to Seymour Hirsch with Terry Gross on Monday night.
If you anticipated the next question, what is the ultimate goal, as explained to me, this is an administration, the Bush administration, with about 6 or so months left, and they really want to do something about Iran. And I think the thinking was, and this is the vice president who's directly involved in this any of these operations with the Joint Special Operation Command. He has a separate direct back channel, I guess you could call it. He communicates directly with people in the field, I'm sure through aides. He's not on the phone necessarily himself, but his office does. And the goal is to provoke enough trouble and hurt enough people and cause enough damage and create enough chaos so that the Iranian government does something aggressive in response. And then you look like you have a country in some sort of acute turmoil. And then you may be perhaps you can have what the White House wants to call a casus belli, a reason for going in and maybe attacking the country.
Suzanne Maloney, what do you think of that?
Well, I have no doubt that there are some that share that sentiment within the administration, as well as some even without outside the administration who would be eager to find a rationale to go after Iran. But it is very hard to judge the specifics of what he suggested, in part because of some of what Dr. Maloney has said about some of the questions I think raised in some of his past reports on these sorts of covert activities. But, you know, in effect, it's also important to distinguish between a couple of different things that the Bush administration has done, or at least has reportedly tried to do. One of the points that Dr. Maloney was just making, I think, was focused specifically on this question of assistance to civil society and democracy advocates in Iran. And this was a major public program of the administration that was announced for the first time in February of 2006 by Secretary Rice when she requested $75 million in supplemental assistance, supplemental funding from the Congress for these sorts of programs. And I think he's absolutely right, entirely correct. This has been a disastrous program, specifically for the people that we intended to help. Almost every known Iranian dissident, people who had suffered, who had spent time in prison for speaking their minds and speaking the truth, came out and denounced this program. There's a long history in Iran of I think, resentment of the machinations of foreign powers, and specifically resentment of the U.S., in part because of the role that the U.S. had in a coup that took place in 1953 that deposed a popularly elected prime minister at the time, and that many Iranians view, rightly or wrongly, as the moment in which their prospects for a full-fledged democracy were lost thanks to Washington. And so the idea of Washington trying to spearhead a democratic movement it creates a lot of resentment, and it is also quite ludicrous when you think about the fact that we've had absolutely no official contact in any serious way for the past almost 30 years, that on a social basis, we just simply don't know what's happening inside Iran. We don't have any sense of who are the potential leaders of a new democratic movement, who are the people with real influence, and what are the issues that could be usefully exploited by a group, how to build a group. I mean, we have no contact with this country. So the idea of trying to spearhead a democratic movement from Washington is really laughable, and as Dr. Maloney said, has had a chilling impact on the very people whom we intended to help. The other dimension of it, of course, is this covert program that Seymour Hersh is writing about, and there the administration has been far less upfront. There were concerns raised in the article by some members of Congress that there hasn't been enough reporting on the program, and I think that's obviously something that needs to be done. You can't have a public conversation about these sorts of programs, but there does need to be some sort of oversight, both of whatever the intelligence community is doing, as well as whatever the military might be doing. Now, Ambassador Crocker's come out and said very explicitly that there are no cross-border operations coming out of Iraq, and I think, you know, we need that kind of transparency, that kind of specificity, because, you know, simply the allegations of the U.S. meddling and trying to provoke ethnic insurgencies in Iran, I think, costs us points and hurts the prospects of both diplomacy as well as any sort of indigenous movement within Iran to try to moderate or change the regime.
All right. Let me see if I can fit in a couple of calls here. We have a lot of people holding here, and I wanted to get into some of the details of Seymour Hersh's article here, so we'll work in some calls. To Aaron in North Oaks. And Aaron, thanks for being so patient. Your question for our guests.
Well, thanks very much. The particular question I have is, I looked at the Israelis who tried to bomb a partially failed state, Lebanon, in order to sort of control the terrorist Hezbollah with their missiles. And my understanding was that we gave technical support for that mission, as well as material support, like with some of the cluster bombs and all that. And we failed miserably in that effort at trying to sort of take out that terrorist group. How can we expect to bomb our way changing the regime in Iran when they may be a corrupt state, but they're not a failed state, and they have like a real army and real kind of material behind them?
Okay, Dr. Milani, can you answer that?
Yes. Well, two things. First, the idea is not that these attacks, that surgical air attacks that is being contemplated, are necessarily intended to change the regime, although some believe in Washington, I think, and maybe in Tel Aviv, and I think that's a very faulty assumption, that if there is such an attack, people will be so angry at the regime that they will rise against the regime. I think the result will be the exact opposite. I think the result is, if there is an attack, this now beleaguered regime, this now isolated regime, this now despised regime will enjoy the nationalist support of many in the country who will think that the nuclear sites that are still deemed to be within the legal bounds have been preemptively attacked. So I think that would be a disastrous idea. The purpose of the attacks would be to delay the development of Iran's military nuclear capacity by a few years. That's the basic assumption. And that, too, again, is the subject of a great deal of controversy. Many experts believe that the attacks will not even achieve that minimum goal because Iran has dispersed these sites to at least 300, and it has heavily fortified them. And if the idea is to get to them, some have argued, some experts have said that U.S. might or Israel might have to use nuclear-tipped bunker busters. And we have studies by concerned scientists in this country that show that hundreds of thousands of people will be affected by that. So to go back, again, because this regime has been very clever over the last 20 years, because it has used Europe, China, Russia very effectively, because it has used U.S. Mistakes in Afghanistan and in Iraq very effectively, it has made the program to a place, its nuclear program, to a place where it is now difficult, if not impossible, to get rid of it. That's why I believe the only solution to it is to have a U.S. foreign policy that allows the Iranian Democratic Movement. There is an emerging coalition, a wide coalition of forces inside Iran who have recognized that this regime is utterly incompetent and incapable of solving Iran's problem. Iran has almost 10% of its population addicted to heroin. Iran's youth, which is 3/5 of the population, is up to 40% unemployed. Unemployment at the society level is close to 15 to 20%. Inflation, Iran is the top 5 countries in inflation rates. These problems are recognized by the people, by enough of the people that are trying to bring about change. War, a rhetoric of war, a foolish foreign policy by the U.S., a foreign policy that says we don't talk to the regime but constantly talks to this regime. The Bush administration has talked tough but has negotiated with this regime consistently. They were negotiating until 3-4 weeks ago in Iraq. That kind of a policy is counterproductive for the sole solution to the problem.
Go ahead, Dr. Milani. Finish.
No, I'm finished. I apologize.
I just wanted to thank you very much. We're at the end of our hour here, and I want to thank you very much for being with us.
It was my pleasure to be with you.
Abbas Milani of Stanford University, head of Iranian Studies. Suzanne Milani, one quick question here before we close. Some of the details in this article that Seymour Hersh wrote for The New Yorker focus on why Democratic members of Congress who have been very critical about the Bush administration's foreign policy would have agreed to a presidential finding like this. Some insight into that.
Well, again, it's hard to know because we don't know what's in the finding and we don't know exactly how it was briefed. But I think, you know, there has been widespread concern, cross-partisan concern for quite some time about the lethality of Iranian actions or actions that have been attributed to Iranian support and financing in Iraq and to a lesser extent Afghanistan. And I think the administration has suggested that we need to push back as much as possible on the Iranians, and that is not, you know, an issue that is simply sort of attractive to neoconservatives. I think across party lines and across ideological lines, there is some support for the idea that we need to deliver a tough message to Tehran, and the administration has at times couched that in the sense that it would actually facilitate some negotiations. Secretary Rice has said we can't talk so long as we're a supplicant. So I can imagine, you know, theoretically that there might have been some willingness and interest to countenance this sort of a program, even from those who are supportive of a negotiated solution with Iran. But obviously that's very speculative.
And let me just tell our listeners here, news crossing the wire right now out of Washington on this. President Bush saying today that diplomacy is the first option to address Iran's nuclear problem, which he is concerned could be used to build a nuclear weapon. But he repeated that all options are on the table. I've always said, this is President Bush, that all options are on the table, but the first option for the United States is to solve this problem diplomatically, he told reporters ahead of the G8 meeting in Japan next week. Suzanne Maloney, thanks so much for being with us for the hour. We really appreciate your insight into this. Suzanne Maloney is a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Iran, and she was joining us this morning from Washington, D.C. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're switching gears and we're talking about the issue of equal parenting and equal household work. Basically doesn't exist, says new research. Why not? With so many more women in the workplace, why is there not more 50-50 sharing of parenting? Why not 50-50 sharing of the household chores? We'll find out what women say about it. We'll find out what men say about it. And we'll find out what you have to say about it. I hope you'll listen in and I hope you'll join into the conversation. That's coming up in just a few minutes here at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at 9. DFL Senate endorsed nominee Al Franken in the studio with us for the hour. We'll have lots to talk about. I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions to ask him as well. So I hope you'll listen in and join us for Al Franken tomorrow morning at 9. And then at 10 o'clock, this is probably one of the most extraordinary books that I've read in quite a while. This is Jill Bolte Taylor's story. She's a neuroanatomist, and she's written a book about her experience of having a stroke as a young woman. I think she was still in her late 30s when this happened, 10 years or so ago. And what she was aware of, even as she was having the stroke, and her experience of a long, long road of recovery, and what she emerged from that experience knowing. And she writes about it in the book. It's going to be a terrific conversation. That is Thursday at 10. This is Mid-Morning.